had a simple divorce. Lauren's attorney asked her if there were any marital assets that she might still be able to claim, and she remembered that she and Brad had a joint bank account that had $12,000 in it. The attorney took Lauren at once to the bank so she could withdraw the money. With that done, he was confident that she would now have something to live on. Brad was livid when he found the $12,000 missing. He filed to freeze money in Lauren's account successfully, and she could use none of the $12,000 to take care of herself as she drew closer and closer to giving birth. Brad battled with Lauren over everything. She had an Oriental rug, a rug that had been in her family for years before they passed it on to her at her wedding. Now Brad claimed that it belonged to him. He even deposed Lauren's mother in his efforts to get it away from Lauren. Lauren's original attorney saw that she was in for a terrible courtroom struggle. "Within a couple of weeks," she recalled, "he told me that I needed a big gun." She hired another attorney, one known for digging in and fighting. But by the time she was 9 months pregnant, the war had just begun, and she was learning that the charming, wonderfully sensitive man she had married had an entirely different side. She would remember that he was extremely litigious and seemed anxious to do whatever he could to make things uncomfortable and difficult in the course of our divorce proceedings. Lauren's due date was during the week of March 26th, which included the Easter weekend, a 3-day holiday. Since she now lived alone, she would have to depend on her telephone to call for help when she went into labor. She was appalled one night during that long weekend when she picked up her phone to make a call and heard only dead air. She discovered that Brad had had her phone disconnected. "I went through some frantic time," Lauren said, "to get the phone hooked up because I was alone." When she did go into labor, Lauren had to count on her family and friends to get her to the hospital. She went through her labor alone, delivering her baby on a soft spring night. She might as well have been an unwed mother. In truth, she would have been better off. Amy Cunningham, a beautiful little girl, made up for a lot of the pain her mother had gone through in the months before her birth. But the pain was not yet over. The phone in Lauren's hospital room rang the day after Amy was born. It was Brad.
"I understand that we have a daughter," he said flatly.
And before Lauren could reply, he went on,
"I wanted to let you know that I have had your car repossessed."
Lauren wasn't even very surprised. This was the Brad she had come, bitterly, to know all too well. He didn't seem thrilled or even moderately happy about the baby. Even so, Lauren knew that Amy would be used as a pawn in Brad's war against her, and she felt a chill. When she had left for the hospital, Lauren's car was parked, she thought safely, in an underground garage at the University Towers where she lived. She learned later that Brad had talked the property manager into letting him into the parking area. The car was gone when she returned from the hospital.
"I don't know how he did it," Lauren said. "He probably had keys."
She never got her car back. Even before Lauren regained her strength after childbirth, the legal fight with Brad accelerated. She was asking for full custody of Amy, while Brad requested joint custody. Their divorce trial was held before Superior Court Judge Stanley Soderlund, who had just been voted the most respected judge in King County, Washington.
"My attorney was not hopeful about my efforts to basically erase Brad from my life," Lauren recalled. "But he said, 'You are hiring me, and if this is what you want to go for, this is what I will ask for.'"
Lauren had requested that Brad undergo psychiatric testing, and he, of course, countered with a request that she be tested, too. In the end, the results were a wash. According to the doctors who evaluated the test results, neither Lauren nor Brad showed any emotional pathology. Ultimately, Lauren put her faith in pure common sense. She was the abandoned spouse, and she figured that when Brad deserted her, he had walked away from Amy, too.
My point was that Brad had relinquished his paternal rights when he walked out before she was born. And the judge said, "You are wrong," he said. "He is the biological father."
Judge Soderlund awarded Lauren sole custody of Amy, but he said he could not prevent her father from seeing her. Soderlund set up very rigid visitation schedules for the first 4 years of Amy's life, commenting that he hoped that Lauren and Brad could work out their own custody arrangements after Amy was four. Amy's visits with her father began when she was a month old. Lauren was ordered by the court to take her to the King County Courthouse and give her new baby to Brad for hour-long visits.
"I had to turn her over to him, and he took her into another room for an hour," Lauren remembered. "It was torture for me. I was scared to death that he was going to leave with her. I was awarded sole custody, which is not what he wanted. It just made me very, very nervous."
Possibly only a new mother can empathize with the terror in Lauren's heart as she carried her month-old daughter onto the creaky elevators of the King County Courthouse and then walked through the marble-lined halls to meet Brad. Every courtroom and chamber in the venerable building has at least two exits. Every floor can be reached by stairways as well as elevators. One courthouse door exits onto Third Avenue and another onto Fourth Avenue, while tunnels run from the courthouse's first floor and basement to two entirely separate buildings. Had Brad wanted to take Amy away, it would have been so easy. But at the end of each hour's visit, he returned the tiny baby girl to her mother. Lauren had no idea what he did while he had the baby. Did he talk to Amy, rock her, walk around with her? Or did he simply put her on a chair and look at his watch until his time was up, relishing Lauren's anguish as she waited beyond the thick oak door? Once Lauren had believed she knew everything there was to know about Brad, now she realized that he had revealed only an infinitesimal portion of his personality to her. If Lauren had hoped to erase Brad from her life, she had failed miserably. The next step of the visitation schedule with Amy, as outlined by Judge Soderlund, was that Brad would come to Lauren's home. He could stay with Amy for up to 2 hours, but he was not allowed to take her off the premises. By the time she was two, Lauren remembered, he could take her for a couple of hours in his car somewhere, and that would gradually increase. When she was three, he could take her for a day and a half, and so forth. For those first 2 years, Brad visited regularly. The divorce proceedings and property settlement were finally resolved, and Lauren was given some interest in Sylvan Habitat, although she never did find out what had become of her missing car. Brad paid her $250 a month in child support. After a while, Lauren no longer felt the absolute terror she had gone through when her little girl was a baby, but she was still uneasy whenever Brad visited Amy. She always had a lingering concern that he might take her away. Lauren knew that Brad had married Cheryl and that she was pregnant. She herself had begun to date the man she would eventually marry, Dr. Ian Stoneham, a psychiatrist. Soon after their wedding, when Amy was two, she and her new husband planned to take a sabbatical to New Zealand. As they prepared to leave for the other side of the world, they discussed how, or whether, they would inform Brad of their departure. Lauren talked with her attorney, who pointed out that there was nothing in her divorce decree that specifically prevented her from taking a sabbatical.
"We both know how litigious Brad is," he said. "My advice to you is to put a letter in the mailbox at the airport saying he can exercise his visitation in New Zealand, and tell him your address there."
That was exactly what Lauren did. And Brad was, predictably, very angry. He went before a judge and obtained a court order that stipulated he had the legal right to go to New Zealand and take Amy away from Lauren. He arranged with his father to accompany him. Sanford bragged to everyone that his son was treating him to a wonderful trip to New Zealand. He didn't mention the purpose of the trip. The nightmare was beginning again for Lauren.
On Mother's Day 1980, Brad arrived in New Zealand and phoned her. She was taken completely by surprise.
"I'm on my way down," Brad said. "Tell me where to meet you. I have a court order in my hand that says I can take Amy."
"Take her where?" Lauren asked, horrified.
"Back to the United States."
Lauren suspected that Brad had deliberately timed his trip so that he would arrive on Mother's Day, giving his demands an extra sadistic twist. Because Amy had always visited with her father for just an hour or two at a time, she really didn't know him, and once again Lauren lived in fear of having her child spirited away. She didn't think that Brad truly cared about Amy, but Amy belonged to him, and Brad didn't let his possessions go easily, whether he really wanted them or not. He was the most aggressive man Lauren had ever encountered. Years later, she would describe his dominant characteristics. "He is very used to getting what he wants and having things the way he wants them. And he gets very frustrated when somebody tries to get in his way." There are few forces stronger than maternal love, that visceral protective stance that grips mothers within minutes of their giving birth. There was no way Lauren could let Brad take Amy.
"I called my attorney, and he appealed the court order and managed to have it overturned, but there was a period of time in New Zealand when I was once again extremely anxious about leaving Amy in the room alone at night for fear Brad would come and try to take her. I think it was an intuitive sense."
Lauren and her husband soon returned to the United States, and as the years passed, Brad continued his child support, but his payments became erratic, and Lauren and Amy saw less and less of him. He had other interests, and he had begun a third family. By the time Amy was 5 or 6, Brad gave Lauren one large check a year, and after a while he sent no money at all. Rather pathetically, although Lauren had never actually met Rosemary, Brad's mother stayed in contact with Amy by mail and always remembered her granddaughter at Christmas and on her birthday. She and Lauren corresponded, and Rosemary had Amy's name added to the roster of the Colville Indians. That way, she too would be eligible for tribal benefits. It was through Rosemary that Lauren learned that Brad was not a quarter Colville Indian, as he had told her. He was actually half Indian. His Indian heritage was something he apparently had tried to minimize, as was the existence of his mother. Chapter 19. Cheryl never really got over her guilt about what she and Brad had done to Lauren. Betraying a friend was completely atypical of her. Her natural inclination had always been to be there for her friends, to help them, and certainly never to destroy them. That she could have been a party to Brad's desertion of Lauren when she was pregnant was almost unbelievable. But Cheryl had never felt as powerful an emotion as the love and commitment she felt for Brad. Her half-sister Susan was only 11 or 12 when Cheryl met Brad, but even she had sensed that Cheryl's marriage to Dan Olmsted was in trouble. "I remember I was in Seattle in October 1977 because my uncle had brain surgery," Susan said. "Cheryl was working for Brad at the Austin Company, and he took us out to lunch in his Mercedes. Brad's jaws were wired because he'd had plastic surgery on them. I remember that, and I remember that I knew somehow that Cheryl and Brad were having an affair." It seemed impossible because Cheryl and Dan had been together so long that their names were practically hyphenated when the family referred to them. Susan couldn't remember a Christmas when Dan hadn't been there. He was part of their family. And he remained part of the family, but now he came to visit alone. When Cheryl took Susan for a drive that Thanksgiving and told her she was getting a divorce, Susan knew who had caused that divorce. It was the man with the Mercedes who had taken them out to lunch a month before, the man with the wires in his jaws, Brad Cunningham. Susan was not surprised, and yet she was surprised.
"Cheryl was so dignified, Things had to have a certain order. She had been so disgusted when Mom left Dad, but...
There were other changes that Susan noticed. Cheryl had always been so confident, so in charge, so confrontive. But now, when she was with Brad, Susan saw that she was different than she had ever been. She had become passive. She deferred to Brad on any and every subject. She adored him. She respected him. She loved him passionately. But Susan wondered sometimes if Cheryl might not also be a little afraid of Brad. After living together for a little over a year, Cheryl and Brad were married in March of 1979, a year after Lauren had given birth to Amy. Cheryl was 2 months pregnant at the time of her marriage, and she was eagerly looking forward to becoming a mother. Cheryl and Brad said their vows in a simple service at the home of friends, and Cheryl's family was not invited. Like all of Brad's weddings, save his first formal ceremony with Lonnie Ann, it was a legal ceremony, but it certainly wasn't romantic or sentimental. In retrospect, Susan could recall no honeymoon period at all in her sister's second marriage. Cheryl seemed happy, yes, but Brad was not the lovey-dovey groom, not even for the first month or so. It seemed almost that Cheryl was part of some plan Brad had, and now that he had accomplished the business of marrying her, there was no point in wasting time on romance. Of course, it was Brad's fourth marriage in 10 years. Perhaps he had no energy for all the typical stages of married life. He had a tiger by the tail in his real estate endeavors. He hinted that he was on the verge of making millions of dollars in a new project in Houston, Texas, and Cheryl had her law degree. She graduated from law school with a shopping list of honors. She was in the top 10% of her class and received the Order of the Coif. She was a beautiful young woman, and he was a handsome man. If ever there was a couple slated for success, it was Brad Cunningham and Cheryl Keaton. And it was Cheryl Keaton. She may have been subservient around Brad, but she insisted on keeping her own name. She had fought hard for her law degree, and it mattered to her that she be a lawyer under her own name. That was the one stand she took with Brad. Otherwise, even in areas where Cheryl had a great deal of expertise, she invariably deferred to Brad's decisions from large issues to relatively small things. Cheryl and Dan had owned the Summer Fun, and Cheryl was an excellent sailor. She had taken classes, and she knew the Coast Guard rules. Brad had owned sailboats, too, but she was the more competent sailor. Still, it was Brad who captained the 36-foot sailboats he often rented. Susan remembered accompanying Brad and Cheryl on one sailing trip to the San Juan Islands in the late 1970s before they were married. They intended to moor at Friday Harbor on San Juan for the night, but they arrived late and found the harbor already jam-packed with boats. While Cheryl and Susan were craning their necks, looking for an empty slip where they might tie up, Brad suddenly dropped anchor right in the middle of the shipping lanes. At first, Cheryl was bewildered. It was such a dumb and dangerous thing to do. Then she showed a flash of her old spirit and demanded that Brad pull up the anchor and get them out of there. But Brad only turned on her and said, "Shut up! This is where we're going to stay!" Susan expected to see the Cheryl she had always known, the one who would fight for what she knew was the right thing to do. Instead, she was shocked to see her sister break into tears. "I was scared myself," she remembered. "You couldn't drop anchor in the shipping lanes. We could have gotten killed." Implacably, Brad went about dropping the sails and acted as though he was going to stay right there all night. Susan was as frightened by her sister's helpless sobs as she was by the thought that their sailboat was probably going to be sliced in two when darkness settled over the harbor. At length, when he was sure that he had made his point, Brad grudgingly raised the sails, hauled up the anchor, and moved on to safer moorage. This nightmare sailing trip was only the first of scores of frightening incidents that Susan witnessed with the man who had taken over Cheryl's life.
She wondered why her sister stayed with Brad, why she married him. Yes, she was pregnant with his child, but that wasn't really forbidden in 1979. Yes, he was handsome, and it seemed as though he was going to be very rich. Cheryl had never lived in homes as nice as those she shared with Brad, but he was so mean sometimes. Susan was, of course, only 13 and couldn't really understand the relationship between her sister and Brad. Cheryl had always loved Seattle from the very moment she arrived at the University of Washington. If it had been up to her, she would have lived in Seattle forever. In 1979, her law practice was embryonic, but she had great confidence that it would grow. She was happy about the baby she carried, too, and was sure she could manage both motherhood and a career if she planned her time well. And she had always been remarkably good about planning her time. She was due to deliver in the fall of 1979. Brad was nothing if not fertile. All of his wives, except Cynthia, who was in her 40s when they married, had conceived almost at the beginning of their sexual intimacy, and he was always proud. Brad seemed pleased that Cheryl was pregnant. Cheryl may have worried a little that summer and fall. Only 2 years before, she had watched Brad become disenchanted with Lauren and desert her when she was pregnant. Cheryl had given up everything to be with Brad then and had gone against even her own moral code. She had let herself be swept away from her first marriage. She had been a willing partner in deceiving her husband and her friend. If Brad could betray Lauren, could he not betray her? It was a fleeting fear, washing over her from time to time and then departing. Brad had a terrible temper and insisted on having his own way, but he was under a lot of pressure getting his growing real estate empire together. Cheryl continually made excuses for his behavior. And from the very beginning of their marriage, she always believed that things would get better. She deferred to Brad in all things and had faith in their future together. She had given up so much to be with him that it was crucial for her serenity to believe that theirs was a true love match that would last forever. Brad took Cheryl to a Cunningham family reunion on Whidbey Island that summer. His relatives found her pleasant and pretty, but quite shy. It was a description that would have baffled her own family, who knew Cheryl as strong and assertive, even take charge. But with Brad, it was almost as if Cheryl knew her place. One time Brad brought Cheryl to the reunion, a Cunningham cousin recalled, and she kind of stood on the sidelines. When I found out later that she was a lawyer, I was amazed. She didn't say one word about what she did for a living. She was just a quiet, pleasant woman. Cheryl had gloried in her pregnancy. She didn't mind at all that her usually slim, perfect figure was temporarily swollen. She proudly wore a tight one-piece bathing suit and posed for pictures when she was over 7 months pregnant. She smiled for another camera as she balanced a wine glass full of milk on the top of her gravid belly. Jess Cunningham was born in October of 1979. A handsome, dark-haired baby boy, he was the image of his father from the start. Cheryl was thrilled to be a mother. It was difficult for her to think about leaving Jess during the day when she went to work. But after 10 weeks of maternity leave, Cheryl had to go back to her law practice on January 2nd, 1980. They needed her salary. Jess went to stay with Sharon McCulloch, a daycare provider who had once been a first-grade teacher. Her husband was a teacher, too. Cheryl and Sharon had already become good friends when Sharon had occasionally taken care of Jess in the first months after his birth. Cheryl felt secure that Jess was in good hands, but she missed him during the hours she was at work. "Jess was always happy," Sharon remembered. "So was Cheryl. Cheryl laughed a lot when I first knew her. I've raised 40 children, but Jess was always special to me. I first started taking care of him when he was 2 weeks old, and I had him with me more than a year."
At this time, Brad and Cheryl were living in Laurelhurst, a long-established upper-middle-class neighborhood near the University of Washington. They had bought the house before they were married, with Cheryl owning 29% and Brad 71%. Set above a terrace of shrubs, the house was white with a big bay window and a wide porch under a sloping roof. Cheryl loved that house, but Brad wanted to live on Bainbridge Island, a half-hour ferry ride across Elliott Bay from Seattle. Cheryl argued that the commute from Bainbridge to her office would add at least 2 hours to her day and would mean that much more time away from Jess. Still, Brad loved the automatic cachet of living on Bainbridge Island, and if that was where he wanted to live, that was where they would live. Occasionally, Brad picked Jess up from Sharon McCulloch's. Somehow, Sharon couldn't bring herself to like him, although he was quite handsome and exuded sexual energy and charm when he wanted to. He had compelling eyes. He had this whole stud image, Sharon remembered. But she found him remote and imperious, and he treated Jess like his property. She noticed that he never called the baby by name. It was always, "Is my son ready to go?" He struck me as extremely possessive, and I was always under scrutiny. Cheryl explained to Sharon that Brad was very particular about Jess, and that he insisted on being informed about any changes in Jess's schedule and in his diet. If I even fed him cereal without Brad's permission, Cheryl had to justify it to Brad, Sharon said. Susan McNanny continued to visit her sister after Cheryl married Brad, and although she was only in junior high school, she was a very intelligent and observant girl. She wondered a little bit about her new brother-in-law when she found a stash of magazines under Brad and Cheryl's bed. They were porno magazines with pictures of young girls in them, she recalled. That Christmas, Brad wrapped up a Playboy and put his name on the card and put it under the tree. It embarrassed Cheryl when he opened it. I don't know why he did that, but holidays never meant anything to Brad. Brad ignored Cheryl's family when they visited. He sometimes didn't even speak to us when we were in his home, Susan said. He respected my father, though. And Brad put up with Susan, possibly because Cheryl insisted, possibly because Susan became a handy babysitter. She went along on trips to Palm Springs, and she often went with Cheryl when she visited her natural father in Vacaville, California. Susan had been a big part of Cheryl's life from the moment she was born, and she would continue to be. Brad seemed so confident and strong, but Susan noticed that he was absolutely terrified of natural disasters, earthquakes, floods, hurricanes. When Mount St. Helens erupted in May of 1980, Brad freaked out, she remembered. He made Cheryl take Jess and go to Canada until he thought it would be safe to come home. Brad was a man who needed to control everything and everyone in his life. Natural disasters were among the few forces over which he had no control at all. Sharon McCulloch had seen Brad's need to control both his son and his wife all too often. In March 1981, a few days before Cheryl and Brad moved from the Laurelhurst house to Bainbridge Island, Cheryl asked Sharon if she could keep Jess a few hours later that evening. They wouldn't be moved out of the house until at least 9 p.m., and then Cheryl had to clean it for the new owners. Sharon said she would be glad to keep him all night. Jess was sleeping peacefully and wouldn't know the difference. Cheryl was grateful. That way she would be free to clean and they wouldn't have to wake the baby up and haul him out into the chill night air. At midnight, however, Sharon woke to a knock on the door. It was Cheryl and she was crying. "Brad's in the car," Cheryl said. "He says I have to take Jess home right now." "But he's been asleep for 4 hours," Sharon said. "I'm so sorry," Cheryl said, "but I have no choice." The Cunninghams didn't live on Bainbridge Island long, only a matter of months. Brad had been negotiating with executives of the Seattle Trust and Savings Bank for a substantial loan that would allow him to work with them as a partner in commercial construction in another state. By the second year of his marriage to Cheryl, he had begun a pattern of traveling most of the time. He had done market studies in Colorado, Alaska, and Texas to determine where there was the most need for apartment and office complexes. I went to Denver, to Alaska, and to Houston. I did a complete market study in Houston, he said years later. This is what I do. Actually, the bank approached us. Seattle real estate wasn't viable. Cheryl and I had $1 million in the bank already, in cash and CDs. The bank offered us a full construction loan, and then they would take 50% of the profits. During the first half of 1981, Brad drove rental cars slowly through cities that looked ripe for building projects. I had a little tie device that was always activated for me to dictate into. I took pictures, I estimated rental density. He returned again and again to Houston, exploring the empty lots and acreage of that green and humid Texas city. The demand for office space in the Houston area was voracious. Tall buildings with mirrored glass windows were springing up like mushrooms, shining obelisks and domes and towers against the Texas horizon, more every month, and still there weren't enough. Brad could almost see his own reflection in those mirrored windows. Houston it would be. Armed with his market study, Brad conferred with Seattle Trust officers and went away with a $1 million startup loan. Brad and Cheryl both signed the loan, but it didn't matter. Washington is a community property state, and his debts were her debts. Brad hired the firm of Baker and Boggs to help him get a license to do business in the state of Texas. He was exhilarated. I like the state of Texas. Eventually, Brad would engage a huge construction firm in Houston. His company was about to build massive office buildings in Houston, and Brad bragged that he would control $600 million. Cheryl was pregnant with her second child, due to deliver in late September. She wanted very much to stay in Washington for the birth, to have her own obstetrician, but Brad insisted that the time was ripe for them to move to Houston. They had the loan, he was negotiating on property, and he had bought a house for them, a very expensive house that was already under construction. It all seemed too fast for Cheryl, but, as always, she went along with Brad's plans. Everything they owned was packed into a moving van. Cheryl went into labor less than a week after they arrived in Houston. Brad was with her for part of her labor, and he insisted on taking pictures of her while she was in the transition state. She asked him not to. She didn't look her best, and she was in pain. Cheryl later told her friend, Sharon McCulloch, that she thought Brad was a ghoul and that she was embarrassed by the camera's intrusion. Michael Keaton Cunningham was born on September 26, 1981, and after his birth, Brad activated the time-release shutter on his camera and posed happily with Cheryl, Jess, and their new baby. Brad didn't visit the hospital again until she was ready to come home. Cheryl later confided to Sharon that that period in September in Houston was the worst in my life. Her mother, now Betty Trosseth, flew down to help out, and Cheryl was glad to have her there, but Brad didn't care for Betty, and he treated her rudely. With two babies now, Cheryl agreed that she would stay home and care for Jess and Michael. At some point, she would certainly resume practicing law, but for the time being, it was Brad's career that was the more important. It had been hard on Cheryl to move to Houston, but there was no question that she would follow Brad wherever he wanted to go. "I've got to go," she had said to Susan. "My child is going, and that's my family." Houston was nothing at all like the Northwest, and Cheryl longed for Seattle with its clear, clean air. Houston was hot and humid day and night. In Seattle, there was always a coolness at night, even if it had been 90 degrees during the day.
In Houston, the air was like a soaking hot blanket. There were bugs and critters that Cheryl had never seen. The music on the radio was different, mostly country. Restaurants featured chicken-fried steak and hot Mexican food instead of salmon, clams, and crab legs. Houston was a different world. However, they weren't there for more than a few weeks before everything started to slide. The move to Houston had cost $10,000. They had put $34,000 down on their new home, and Cheryl had quit her law practice. They hadn't even unpacked when Seattle Trust and Savings Bank executives called Brad with stupefying news. They had changed their mind about the million-dollar loan. "It was only a few days after Michael was born," Brad would recall. "They said they had new management and didn't want a project that far away." Brad had assured Cheryl that the Texas move was a good thing, a vital step on their way to financial independence. Now the balloon had burst, and they were still committed to buying a billion-dollar property. Moreover, Brad's boast of $1 million in the bank was undoubtedly inflated. In reality, he had credit lines of $10,000 or $15,000. He vowed to sue Seattle Trust and Savings, and Cheryl drew up a letter of detrimental reliance, formally charging the bank with leaving them in such a tenuous position. "We had to get a new loan," Brad recalled. And he did. Few entrepreneurs could be as convincing as he was. Even with his back to the wall, he was able to persuade a Texas bank to grant him an open-ended $4.4 million loan. He was back in business and, in Brad's mind, the huge commercial complex he visualized, Parkwood Plaza, was as good as finished. While Brad busied himself putting the project together, Cheryl was delighted to be raising Jess and Michael, and she was proud of Brad. Their two little boys were as different from each other as they could be. Jess was very bright and active. He looked just like Brad. Michael was just as intelligent, but he was a calmer, sweeter baby. Or maybe it was because second babies just seem easier. Mikey looked like his mother. Brad Cunningham would have a dozen excuses for the financial disaster that Parkwood Plaza became. His huge loan had built-in dangers. It had to be repaid whether his project was finished or not. And many years later, Brad would blame the construction companies he hired, the bonding company, and the grim outlook for the Texas economy. He took no personal responsibility for failure whatsoever. If it had been up to him, Parkwood Plaza would be today a booming concern. "The Parkwood Plaza project started out fine in February 1982, he would later testify. "It was under construction and bonded by March. The architect started recommending withholds from construction draws. The construction company hadn't done the work. We had problems by May or June." He said that he himself discovered flagrant violations, such as high-voltage power lines buried much too shallowly under the concrete floors. "The contractor put 440-volt lines 8 inches underground when they should be 2 feet under. I'm going to go ahead and tell you the truth. I was leaving one day for the airport, and I saw workers unloading pipe on concrete, breaking the pipe. I told the contractor not to install the pipe. When I came back, I crawled under and saw broken pipes installed. I took a camera. I didn't trust the contractor. When the buildings didn't meet plans or specs, it gave the permanent lender a way to back out. Around June 15th or 20th, the construction company fired all the architects. I hired 3D International myself, one of the largest construction companies in the United States. The contractor kept working, and I withheld $1 million because it was defective. He had 10 days to fix it. The contractor didn't. I had a bond. By October 1982, I fired the contractor and tried to complete it myself. I had to correct the code violations." To listen to Brad explain his maneuvers to build Parkwood Plaza was to move into a world where disbelief had to be suspended. He was a Superman, financing, bulldozing, building, laying electrical conduit, lifting whole walls, seemingly all by himself. I was working equipment, hiring crews, on-site, paving. It's called mitigating your damages. I finished building D, and I opened a secretarial service. I hired out 9 offices. I worked on A and tried to sell the other buildings. The bonding company basically said, sue me. In reality, Brad had coaxed Cheryl away from Seattle and her thriving law practice into a monetary sinkhole. Despite Brad's confident promises, it was apparent that they had just missed the boat. Houston was rapidly becoming, not just for Brad, but for all but the most solidly grounded builders, a wasteland. Suddenly, in early 1982, the bottom of the Texas economy had sprung a leak through which first oil and then all good things would eventually escape. The oil boom that had promised to be endless had begun to lose momentum, and a world oil glut caused gasoline prices to plummet. Houston's real estate dreams of glory began to evaporate. Jobs were drying up, and nobody needed or could afford expensive office space. Newly finished buildings stood empty, and construction stopped on half-built units. Mirrored windows soon reflected only the end of an era, and Brad was left with mostly never-started or half-finished buildings and a mountain of debt. He had gambled, made promises with money that depended on filling Parkwood Plaza. He was in trouble. Brad blamed construction delays. He insisted that if the buildings had gone up according to his scheduling, they would have been finished and all the offices rented. What had happened, he argued, was not his fault. There had been enough money there, but the construction company had let it trickle away. Now it was drying up fast, and Brad was a man who had always liked to live high. He was not about to go backward when he had long since become accustomed to fine cars, gourmet restaurants, and the best of everything. The Cunninghams could no longer afford such a life. Things looked bad for Brad and, of course, for Cheryl, too. They discussed their predicament. He didn't want to leave Houston if there was a chance he could salvage what he had there, but they needed an income to keep him going. Cheryl was an attorney, and she was good. Brad suggested that they separate for a while, but only so they could rebuild their financial base. Regretfully, Cheryl agreed to his plan for her to move back to Seattle and practice law. She would take Jess and Michael with her, and Brad would remain in Houston to try to hold back, or at least slow down, financial disaster. In September of 1982, Cheryl took her 2 little boys and moved to Seattle. She was relieved to be out of the Houston climate and back home, but she missed Brad, and she worried that Michael and Jess would forget their father. She put a map on the wall and stuck colored pins in it, painstakingly explaining to 3-year-old Jess and 1-year-old Michael, who didn't really understand, where their daddy was. She talked about Brad constantly so that the boys wouldn't think of him as some shadowy figure. He was their daddy, and one day they would all be together again. Cheryl started work with Garvey, Schubert, and Bearer, moved into a house on Bainbridge Island, placed both Jess and Michael in Sharon McCulloch's daycare center, and set out to help Brad financially. She did well. Cheryl, so cowed in her marriage, was an absolutely spectacular litigator. She had all the raw material to become a successful attorney and more. She was a natural debater. She had the drive, and she had the staying power. She could be as fierce as any bulldog, holding on until she made her point. Senior partners at Garvey Schubert noticed her right away. She made enough money to support herself and the boys and to send more to Brad in Houston. If she worried that Brad might be continuing his penchant for extramarital sex, she didn't say so aloud.
She may or may not have had reason to worry. Brad and the woman who worked as his secretary were extremely close during his time in Houston. He had never been a man who could exist long without the intimate company of a woman. Brad traveled to Seattle every once in a while. He spent more time in Yakima, where he and his father were involved in new business projects. At one point, he hired two men from Yakima to fly down to Houston and transport vehicles and equipment from the job site in Texas up to the Tampico property. Despite his grim financial situation, Brad continued to drive Mercedes cars. He usually picked them up when they were imported through Los Angeles. Cheryl went with him on some of those trips, and on one occasion they were in a near-fatal automobile accident. Though they survived, the Mercedes-Benz didn't. Cheryl's family never learned all the details of the crash. Occasionally, Brad caught up with his other children. He visited with his third child, Amy, and explained to Lauren why he was behind in his support payments. He told her he planned to sue the construction company responsible for his financial troubles and said he was confident that he would win back everything he had lost and more. A major Houston law firm was interested in his case, and he expected them to take the suit on a contingency basis. Brad also kept track of Lonnie Ann and his first two children, Kate and Brent, although Lonnie Ann had done her best to hide their whereabouts from him. Brad learned that Kate was living temporarily with her maternal grandparents in Seattle. He would check into that. He was always alert to any failures in parenting that Lonnie Ann might demonstrate. Despite the three children he had fathered since Lonnie Ann won custody of Kate and Brent, he never forgot the ignominy of having her beat him in court. During one of his visits home, Brad and Cheryl took their boys to a Cunningham family reunion. Cheryl put Jess and Michael to sleep in a tent while the adults visited and the teenagers fooled around with fireworks. Brad's presence at the Cunningham reunions never went unnoticed. He was a kind of lightning rod who needed to be the center of attention. "He was always like that," one of Brad's cousins remembered. "A long time ago, he called a bunch of us over. He was just a young guy then. And he said he was gonna show us something, but we were never supposed to tell. He opened the trunk of his car, and he had all these automatic weapons in there." During the reunion in 1983, one of the rockets from the fireworks went awry and zoomed into the side of the tent where Jess and Michael mapped. Smoke circled up, and Cheryl screamed. Brad, his cousin recalled, just sat there as if nothing had happened. "I remember he only said, 'Hey, that's a flame-retardant tent. I paid $500 for it. It had better not burn.'" Everyone but Brad ran toward the fire, but it was Cheryl who got the babies out of the burning tent. Brad acted like nothing happened at all. He wasn't worried. He was just mad that the tent didn't live up to its guarantee. Chapter 20. In 1982, Kate Cunningham, Brad's oldest child, was 12, a tall, slender girl with thick, dark hair like her father's. She was also exceptionally lovely. Kate had not lived with her father, of course, since she was a toddler, and her memories of him were confusing and somewhat fearful. He was so very big, and his reasoning seemed to change with the wind. "When we were little," Kate would remember, "my father always told us to tell him the truth. He would say, 'I won't spank you if you tell the truth.' And so we would tell him the truth, and he would spank us anyway. That didn't make sense." When they were 8 and 7 and spent time with their father, Brad played frisbee with Kate and her younger brother Brent, paying them a quarter for every one they caught. Kate was better at that because she was older, and that angered Brad. He wanted his son to be the athlete, not his female child. "He kicked Brent in the rump all the way to the car to punish him for being clumsy," Kate recalled. Brent took after his mother in appearance. He was a cute little kid with red hair cut in the bowl cut popular at the time.
He looked nothing at all like his father, and he never would. Even so, Kate sensed that she had always been Brad's least favorite child. Cloaking his words in a thin veneer of humor, he would tell Brent,
"God, your sister has no brains. Don't be like your sister. She has no common sense."
"We'd be on vacation or something, and I wouldn't be allowed to swim," Kate said. "I'd have to take care of the towels because of something I'd done. I was 9 or 10. Maybe I told stories or I would exaggerate, and that made him mad."
Brent felt sorry for her and tried to help. Later, when her father was married to Cheryl, Cheryl too felt sorry for Kate. She was always being confined to her room for something she had done to displease Brad. It was Cheryl who would let her out and tell her to come to dinner with the rest of them. But Kate Cunningham had a resilience about her. She was a strong-minded girl. She would need that strength. Brad remained in Houston in late 1982 and through the spring of 1983, while Cheryl tried to keep his face alive in the minds of Jess and Michael and make him a part of their family even though he was so often far away. When Brad returned to Seattle, Lonnie Ann and Lauren were forced by law to permit visitation with their children. They both longed to have Brad out of their lives, but he insisted on contact with his offspring. If his visits were sporadic, he wanted it that way. When Brad claimed Kate or Brent or Amy, he behaved with them as he did with Jess and Michael. They were his. They belonged to him. The women who had given them birth and cared for them were only convenient vessels and quite dispensable. On one of his visits to Seattle, after he had learned that Kate was living with her grandparents, Brad picked her up one evening to take her out to dinner with Jess and Michael. But when he headed back toward her grandparents after dinner, he drove right past the turnoff to their street.
"Are you going to be living with us on Bainbridge?"
Jess asked Kate excitedly.
"No,"
Kate said. "Yes, you are," Brad said, and Kate realized that he must have already announced that to her little half-brothers.
Kate didn't know what to say.
She wanted to live with her mother, and she had only been visiting her grandparents. She didn't want to live with her father.
"I went to court and got an order to have you live with me legally. I'm now taking custody of you," her father told her, adding that Lonnie Ann was not a fit mother. He said that Lonnie Ann couldn't deal with her any longer and that Kate would now be living with him. When her father said something, it was so definite. Kate didn't even consider protesting. From the time she could remember, she had sensed that her mother was afraid of her father. She had seen that her mother always backed down, capitulated, struggling to maintain peace. Kate didn't live on Bainbridge Island long. When Brad returned to Houston, he took her with him. She would never understand why. Maybe he wanted company. Maybe he simply wanted a whipping boy, or, in her case, a kicking girl. Everything she did seemed to annoy him, and he apparently had little use for anything female. It was to be the beginning of a horrendous ordeal for Kate. It was also perhaps a period that would demonstrate for the first time what a tremendously strong girl she was. She may well have inherited the best of her father's traits, his self-confidence, his refusal to give up in spite of great odds, and a hard pride. She would need all of that armor to survive so far away from her mother, her brother, and her grandparents. Brad enrolled Kate in junior high school in Houston, and she tried, tentatively, to make friends. She was graceful and athletic, as both her parents were. She won a medal in track and brought it home to show her father. Instead of being proud of her, Brad was annoyed.
"He took it away from me," Kate recalled. "I don't really know why. He told me I wasn't to leave my room, that I was being punished, but I didn't know why. I won several ribbons and other awards. He took those, too. I never got them back from him."
Kate was continually confused.
She wasn't sure why she was in Houston in the first place, and she never knew what was going to make her father angry. Her punishments were usually the removal of privileges or of the belongings that meant the most to her. "He did that frequently," she recalled. "I wouldn't know exactly what I did. He would take my clothes away, the things you would wear out normally, and he made me wear clothes that you would use to paint the house, you know, your ripped-up bummy clothes. I was obliged to wear those. I wasn't allowed to do any preparation for school, like curling my hair, the things you did when you were young. Sometimes I could earn back my clothes, and I'd have them for a while, and then he'd take them away again, and I could never understand why. I got to the point where I'd go into school early and get ready in the bathroom. After the after-school activities, before I'd go home, I'd get my hair all wet and take all the makeup off. I wasn't allowed to wear that. Basically, he'd take away all my privileges. It was embarrassing for me to go into school with my hair all over the place and my bummy clothes. That didn't feel good. Everyone in school wasn't doing that, and you had that peer pressure. I got to the point where I'd get ready in the morning, even if I had to miss a class to do it. He didn't know I was doing that." Lonnie Ann knew that Kate was with her father in Texas, but she had no way to bring her back. She could only try to comfort her daughter when Kate was able to sneak away to a phone booth and call. It was agony for Lonnie Ann to hear her sob on the phone and not be able to help her. For Kate, the only semblance of a normal family life occurred when Brad brought the little boys down for a visit and Kate babysat them. Sometimes Cheryl could get away, too, for a short time and visit Brad. He had assured Cheryl that living with him was the best thing for Kate. Her mother wasn't capable of taking care of her. Brad spent a good deal of his time at his office. He had to. He was still fighting desperately to save the real estate empire that had been burgeoning only a year earlier. He ran a secretarial service, although the details of that business enterprise were vague. Apparently, he was using office space in the one building he had completed before Parkwood Plaza faltered. Just like her mother a dozen years earlier, Kate was required to let Brad know where she was at all times, and she soon became the target for her father's rage and frustration. Eventually, she had to go to a counselor because she had begun to break under the abuse. In her sessions, or whenever they were around other people, her father jokingly, even fondly, turned away her accusations. "Stop lying, Kate. Why are you doing that? Knock it off. Be a good girl." "He sounded very genuine," Kate marveled years later. "You almost felt like you were crazy because there wasn't a hint of maliciousness. It was as if I was a liar or something, and it almost made it worse." Was she somehow to blame? No. He was the one who told her over and over that she was nothing more than garbage. He was the one who told her that her mother was a bad mother who had mistreated Kate and Brent, who had kept a filthy house, who had done terrible things. He had explained to her through gritted teeth that all women were liars, all women were garbage. "He said I was going to be like my mother," Kate recalled. "He said I was going to be pregnant by the time I was 18. But Kate knew what Lonnie Ann was really like. She had chosen always to live with her mother. "She was sensitive. She was human. I could talk to her about things. I could come to her when I had a problem. She was a very good person." All of Brad's abuse took place behind the locked and alarmed door of his apartment. No one knew that he was anything but a concerned, long-suffering single parent. Brad would occasionally tell Kate that they were going for a drive. "Then," she related, "he would pull over and scream at me and tell me I was garbage and stupid and ugly, and I was no good and I would never amount to anything, that I was crazy. Those things sort of stick with you after a while." Kate was like a little mouse trapped in a cage, constantly beset with different signals.
Sometimes, when her father raved on and on about how terrible her mother was, she would break into sobs. And then, as they were about to go out into the world that saw Brad as a suave executive and a concerned father, he would change instantly and become that person. "Come, give your father a hug. I love you."
I wouldn't hug him, and he'd say, "Oh, hug your father." And I'd go to school so screwed up. I didn't have friends because people thought I was weird.
There was little point in Kate trying to have friends anyway. Brad insisted on having a timetable of exactly where she would be and with whom and pertinent telephone numbers. It wasn't worth the effort to have friends. She was in junior high, and none of the other kids had to account for every second of every day. Brad was especially suspicious of boys. Once Kate got off at the wrong bus stop and called Brad's office to ask him to come pick her up. He said he would be right there. But one of the boys in her class happened to live a few houses away, and he invited her to come and see his dog's new puppies. While she was looking at the puppies, Brad arrived to pick her up, and when he didn't find her at the bus stop, he drove off. When she called the house, he was angry and accusing. "You'd better get here in 15 minutes or you're grounded." She was 2 miles from home, and she knew she couldn't run that fast.
"I tried, but I didn't make it."
Brad accused Kate of having sex with the 12-year-old boy.
"It was ridiculous," she recalled. "He was the class nerd. I was only 5 minutes late to meet my father. He went on about how women are like that, and he'd tell me all about his sexual experiences, which I didn't want to hear. He told me what I was going to be like when I was older, how I'd be around men. He was saying all it would take would be some man saying, 'I love you,' and you're going to let them screw you. He said I was fooling around with this boy, and that's why I wasn't there, which wasn't true, but he wouldn't listen to me."
Brad continually isolated Kate and tried to destroy any vestige of ego she might have left. He didn't want her to have any confidants. He told her that none of the secretaries at his office really liked her. "You're just the boss's daughter." Kate called Lonnie Ann every day from school and cried. It seemed to her that she was never going to get away from her father. She was afraid to show it on the outside, but Kate was angry. She was also a gutsy little girl, and she began to formulate an escape plan. She squirreled away every bit of money her father gave her, going without lunch and any of the movies or other treats she might have bought. She hid her money in her closet, counting it carefully as it grew closer to the amount she would need for a one-way plane ticket. Brad kept the alarm system on whenever they were home, so Kate couldn't open any door without setting it off, but she knew where the keys were, and she finally figured out how to disarm it. If she actually made it onto a plane, Kate knew that her father would check the airline rosters out of Houston. She planned to book flights on her departure day on every airline under her own name. On one of the flights, she would use a false name. That would be the plane that would carry her far away from Houston. But Kate, as smart as she was only 12. Brad had asked one of his women friends to befriend her, and Kate trusted her.
"I told her about my plan, and she told him, and I went on restriction again."
By the spring of 1983, Brad's grip on his Texas fortune was loosening. But he apparently had a plan. As a grown woman, she could no longer recall the details, but Kate remembered how Brad laughed as he told her how he was going to beat the bankruptcy courts. Kate recalled that he showed her a page he had typed listing his assets. She was impressed and baffled when he filed for bankruptcy in June.
"He used his credit cards because he didn't have to pay the bills. When I came back and told my mother, she didn't believe me because she said, 'No one does that.' But he did."
Verbal abuse from her father had long since become an almost everyday thing for Kate, but there was one incident so frightening that she would remember it years later as clearly as if it had just happened. She had almost finished the school year in Houston. She was in her last week in the eighth grade when some gaffe of hers set Brad off into the most violent episode she had yet endured. He had told me to come straight with him about everything, meaning any single secret or lie I could have ever possibly had. At this moment, I was supposed to tell him. I told him everything, except there was just one thing that I wanted to keep secret to me. I felt it was my secret garden, that it didn't hurt anyone, and it wasn't any of his business. Brad had had to make a trip to Seattle, but he wanted to be sure that Kate remained in Houston, and he had arranged to have her stay with the family of an employee. This man, who worked in one of Brad's warehouses, had casually mentioned some facet of Kate's life that Brad didn't know about. Certainly nothing big. But Brad's overweening possessiveness was akin to his need to know the most minute information about his children, right down to what kind of cereal Jess had been given. That someone other than himself would know anything about Kate that he didn't know was anathema. When Kate got home from school that day, Brad was talking on the phone with the man whose family had cared for her while he was away. She saw that her father was coldly angry, but she had no idea why. It began as sadistic teasing. Brad took a pen and ran it up and down Kate's nose. She pushed it away, and he asked in a puzzled tone, "You don't like that?"
"No."
"Oh, that's too bad," he said sarcastically. He kept running the pen along the bridge of her nose, and Kate, annoyed and a little frightened, backed away from him, around and around the room, around the coffee table. I would back up, going out of my room into the living room. He was trying to push me down. I'd lose my footing and take two or three steps back. That's when he was screaming at me. I didn't even know him at that point. It was like he was a different person. There was a whole different fire in his eye, and he scared me. Brad ordered Kate to take off her clothes. They were, he said, his because he had bought them. "You didn't come straight with me," he yelled, and he grabbed armfuls of her clothes out of her closet until it was empty except for a few bummy garments. Then he threw a large pre-folded cardboard packing box at Kate as if he were throwing a frisbee, hitting her in the mouth with a sharp corner and bruising her face. He ordered her to put it together.
"I started to really get scared, and I was shaking," Kate remembered. "And he told me I'd better put it together and that I'd better catch this tape he was throwing at me or I'd be in really big trouble. I started to really freak out."
Kate managed finally to fit the complicated tab and fold box together, and Brad tossed her clothes inside. Then he walked to the kitchen and grabbed the garbage and poured it into the box on top of her clothes.
"He was screaming at me," she recalled years later, her voice betraying the damage done. "He told me that I was no longer part of this family, that my little brothers would grow up not knowing I existed."
Brad grabbed Kate and drew his mammoth fist back and told her that he would just love to hit me. But he knew I would tell, that I had a big mouth and I would tell everybody. But he said one day he was going to do it, and how bad he wanted to hit me. Brad ordered Kate to carry the box down the stairs of the apartment building. It was terribly heavy for a slight 12-year-old girl. She was tall for her age, about 5'5", but she didn't weigh very much, and the only way she could hold the box was to bend her knees, balance it on the front of her thighs, and take the steps one at a time.
"He tried to kick me in the butt, which was something he liked to do to my brother and me when he wanted to be ornery," Kate said. "And so I tried to dodge him while I was carrying this thing.